The age of the Usuli merged to heads. War with Russia left a lasting impression on the Iranians and on the shaping of their responses to the outside world. Though in their collective memory there were many foreign invasions, this was the first loss of territory to a Christian power since the rise of Islam. The last land war with a Christian power was in 1071 at the Battle of Manzikert in eastern Anatolia, between the Seljuk Empire of Iran and the Byzantine Empire, which ended in the former's decisive victory. The only significant Iranian defeat by Christians occurred in 627, when the Byzantine Emperor Heraclius defeated the Sasanian Empire in the Battle of Nineveh in northern Mesopotamia, 285 miles north of Ctesiphon. Defeat in the hands of the Russians was significant, since it made early Qajar Iran more conscious of its Shi'i identity, independent of the sphere of the state, but related to it, performance in the war. The high-ranking Shi'i jurists, the Mojtahids, controlled a growing religious domain that included the judiciary, the mosque, the madrasa, and religious public endowments. These institutions gave them considerable social status and political leverage, which they began to exploit at times to their own advantage, often at the expense of mystical or other non-Sharia interpretations of Islam. The closer involvement of the Shi'i Mojtahids in the affairs of the community, and eventually the conduct of the state, especially after calling for jihad against Russia after defeat in the first round of the war, could not have come about without a key doctrinal component. By the middle of the 18th century, the Shi'i ulama had to reinvent themselves to regain the ground they had lost since the fall of the Safavids. They were no longer functionaries of the state, nor were they bookish scholars in the secluded seminaries of Isfahan and Najaf, endlessly debating the minute details of Shi'i hadith and brandishing hefty glosses and commentaries on the work of earlier jurists. The Usuli Shi'i Mojtahid's answer to the crisis of the post-Safavid era was to come up with a new legal approach to Sharia that stressed the methodology of jurisprudence, or roots of jurisprudence, usul al-fiqh, as the key to a broader legal application of the principle of etjihad. The sole authority to exercise etjihad, or legal judgment based on sources of Islamic law and through limited use of deductive analogy, distinguished the Shi'i ulama, and more distinctly the Usuli Mojtahids, from their contemporary Sunni counterparts. For Mojtahids, the study of jurisprudence, fiqh, was the most authentic articulation of Islamic Sharia, and they, as jurists, were the only experts qualified to interpret Islamic law. The Usuli jurisprudence, in effect, equipped the Mojtahids with claims for collective representation on behalf of the hidden imam. The hidden imam, or the lord of the age, was the Shia reference to the Islamic Mahdi, whose advent from the world of invisible, according to the Shi'is, was expected to trigger the end of the time. Such self-assumed authority offered doctrinal grounds for the Mojtahids to demand that their followers, or more specifically their emulators, seek their legal and moral opinion and follow their expert advice in all matters of Sharia. The doctrine of emulation, taqlid, obliged Shi'i believers to follow an individual Mojtahid of their choice in all issues of Islamic law. Any qualified Shi'i Mojtahid could issue independent legal opinions, fatwas. More important, given their social implications, these opinions were to exert, at least in theory, an unprecedented degree of control over the beliefs and practices of followers. Progressively over the course of the 19th century, the binary of ijtihad taqlid became axial to the Mojtahid's legal authority, and at times key to their social and economic power. Emulation involved a wide range of duties, as benign as saying prayers behind a Mojtahid during congregational Friday prayer, and as critical as conducting jihad, even though the latter duty was not always seen within the Mojtahid's jurisdiction. Even the permissibility of holding Friday prayer long was disputed among the Shi'i jurists. Earlier in the Safavid era, the followers of the declining Akhbari school had rejected Friday prayers on the basis that in the absence of the hidden imam, no authority has the legitimacy to lead public prayers. By the late 18th century, however, the Usulis came to accept congregational prayer, utilizing it as a powerful tool to expand their authority and display their personal acumen. The dynamics of the Mojtahed's interaction with their followers, however, was a complex one. Shi'ism never set objective standards for Ijtihad beyond unspecified years of studying various subjects in the madrasa's colloquium and acquiring some kind of informal accreditations from their teachers. The ulama's greater autonomy from the state in the post-Safavid era made the latter practice more prevalent. The success of the Mojtahids thus largely hinged on their followers. To attract more followers and create a larger constituency, so to speak, a Mojtahid had to listen to his followers, comply to a certain extent with their wishes, and even sometimes succumb to demagogy and crowd-pleasing. The intricate interplay between the Mojtahids and their followers was further complicated because of the so-called one-fifth of the expendable income, known as khums, and other religious dues dispersible to the Mojtahids by their followers. Collecting the one-fifth, at times referred to as the share of the imam, became the major source of income for the Usuli Mojtahids in the Qajar era, as they began to assume greater authority over the affairs of the community. The inefficacy of the literalist Akhbari approach to Sharia became more apparent with the rise to power of the Qajars and the return of some degree of urban tranquility. It is not a coincidence that Usuli Mojtahids grew in number and influence during the same period. Contrary to Nader Shah, who wished to emasculate or even destroy the ulama establishment of the Safavid period, Aga Muhammad Khan and then Fath Ali Shah appeased the Mojtahids and sought their blessing in order to buttress their lack of sacred descent. The Mojtahids yielded to the Qajar's wishes from a position of relative strength, not merely as clients of the state. At the close of the 18th century, many Mojtahids returned from the Shi'i cities of southern Iraq, where some of the ulama had taken refuge after the fall of the Safavids. Soon, the new class of the Usuli Mojtahids began to build an urban network, while the Qajars were still consolidating their power over the country. The new dynasty, and Fath Ali Shah in particular, could hardly afford to lose support of this influential class of the urban elite. For most of the 19th century, however, the Mojtahids remained partners in power with the Qajar state. They did so by remaining within the self-defined boundaries of their legal mandate, what they called authority to adjudicate, velayat-e-Qajar, and by leaving the political affairs of the realm to the state. While Sharia was the domain of the Mojtahids, the customary law, urf, or more broadly, the political affairs, was more or less left to the government and its agents. The Usuli ulama, despite their legal activism, never really abandoned the Shi'i idea of avoiding the temporal government, a relic of piety-minded tendencies in early Islam. In theory, they considered any government authority in the absence of the imam of the age unjust and tyrannical, a presumption that required their distance from political affairs and from holders of political power. That in the post-Safavid era, the chief centre for Shi'i learning remained in Ottoman Iraq, and therefore outside the jurisdiction of the Qajar state, created a new power dynamics, one that persisted throughout the 19th and the 20th centuries. Fath Ali Shah's numerous gifts to the ulama of Najaf and Karbala, who were mostly of Iranian origin, as well as his lavishing of enormous sums in cash, gold, and jewels for the restoration and beautification of Shi'i holy shrines of southern Iraq, helped elevate him and later his successors to the position of patrons of Shi'i scholarship and protectors of the Shi'i community of Iraq. Despite Fath Ali Shah's patronage of Iranian Mojtahids and the revival of teaching centers in Isfahan, Qom, Kashan, and elsewhere, Najaf maintained its standing as the center of scholarship and produced important texts in jurisprudence while also training Mojtahids at an advanced level of their education. Najaf scholars were known for their conservative approach on issues of jurisprudence, and they were universally recognized as authorities by generations of Mojtahids throughout the Shi'i realms. The works of Sheikh Muhammad Hassan Najafi, a jurist of Iranian origin who specialized on rules and rituals, furu'a, exemplified the high receptivity of Najaf scholarship. His major work, Jawahir al-Kalam fi Shar Shara'i al-Islam, the Jewels of the Words in Explication of Religious Laws of Islam, was a 44-volume compendium of Shi'i religious rules and rituals based on the work of the well-known 13th-century jurist Muhaggege Hilli. Completed in 1846, a high point for Najaf scholarship, it went through 24 printed editions between 1846 and 1957, and many editions still later. Its 1981 Beirut edition amounts to more than 18,000 pages. Widely used as a comprehensive manual, Javaher glaringly revealed the insularity of the Shi'i legal scholarship. Loyal to the antiquated organization of the Shi'i law, it was divided into four major categories of devotional acts, contracts, individual obligations, and religious commands. In all, about 46% of the work was devoted to purification rites, taharat, and devotional acts, ibadat. Within this category, a hefty 26% was on pollutants and rules of purity, 40% on prayer, and the remaining 44% on fasting, hajj, and religious duties. Placing great emphasis on the issues of purity and pollutants, perhaps a relic of the deep memory of the Zoroastrian rituals of the pre-Islamic past, Javaher discussed with fetishistic precision the minutiae of pollutants and methods of purification. Scatological cleansing in particular, including ritual purging of traces of urine and excretion, as well as menstrual discharge and other tainting bodily fluids, sexual intercourse, corpses, and pollutant animals, received overzealous treatment. Other polluting situations, such as coming into contact with the religiously impure, including infidels, were also discussed at length. Beyond cleansing and devotional acts, some 24% of Javaher discussed the laws of contract, ogud, to include marriage and trade, and 21% individual obligations, igahat, such as methods and rules governing inheritance and divorce. By contrast, only 9% of the compendium was devoted to the commands, akam, of which the most significant was enforcement of the penal code. Operating on the Islamic principle of enforcing the good and prohibiting the evil, harsh penalties, hads, and laws of retribution, kesas, were prescribed, including lashing, stoning, and beheading, for such breaches as drinking, playing music, gambling, homosexual relationships, out-of-wedlock intercourse, and prostitution. What was most remarkable about Najafi's comprehensive treatment was the preoccupation with individual behavior and the means of controlling and policing it. This ritualistic aspect, more than civil or public conduct, interested the Shi'i jurists over the centuries with little, if any, deviation. What determined the Sharia primarily and predominantly were rituals and individual conduct, not the modern sense of law. Remarkably, despite jurists' great emphasis throughout the Qajar period on the methodology of law, as is evident in the field of usul e fiqh, the traditional division of legal categories remained firmly in place. Inaccuracies in defining contract versus individual obligations versus religious commands remained unresolved, and the two categories of approbated, mustahab, and reprehensible, makruh, the grey areas of the law, so to speak, were preserved. Most striking, Shi'i legal concern never extended to the areas of public law or attempted to define the social rights and obligations of the individual in the modern sense, nor did it make the faintest attempt to define the boundaries of state power. Instead, it adamantly adhered to the rituals and rules that regulated the life of the individual. Even then, it remained notoriously bookish and out of touch with the realities of the society it was supposed to serve. A vast number of intricate cases discussed in Javaher, as in all compendiums on fiqh, were purely academic and had little, if any, practical implications. More than anything, they represented their author's legalistic obsessions and the scholastic acrobatics of the madrasa environment in which they were produced. Javaher was rife with hypothetical cases devoid of any practical application, implausible, even bizarre situations of bodily defilement, and remote and highly improbable annulment of ritualistic ablution, daily prayers, fasting, and correct practice of Hajj rituals. Like most scholastic and exclusive teaching environments, It was as if these elaborations were to impress jurist counterparts and rivals in the madrasa, rather than having any useful purpose even for jurists' own students and training as mujtahids. Yet, despite rising rivalries and bickering among the jurists, at moments of crisis, the ulama felt their duty to defend the survival of the sharia, what they called the kernel of Islam, Bayzeya Islam, even at the cost of contesting the state. Such interventions, however, were far less common and far more anecdotal than some modern apologists for the authority of the ulama versus the Qajar state would like us to believe. Contrary to popular images of the ulama as champions of the weak, most mujtahids were supplicating subjects of the Shah and admirers of Qajar rule. At no time before the end of the 19th century did any Shi'i mujtahid of significance question the legitimacy of the temporal rulers of their time. The few who did protest the government's action, such as during the Rigi protest in 1891 and 1892 against the concession granted by the Qajar state to a British company, did so at the urging of political activists, and only briefly and on specific issues. The early incubation of the Usuli school took place in the seminaries of Najaf in Ottoman lands. Though safely distant from the seat of the Persian Shah, they were more dependent on their Qajar patrons to protect them from the Sunni Mamluks of Iraq and later, in the early Tanzimat era, from the Ottomans. The first generation of Usuli jurists, mostly teachers rather than judges, overcame their Akhbari opponents in Najaf under the leadership of Aga Muhammad Bakhber Behbahani, 1706-1791, the recognized initiator of the Usuli school in modern times, who is often esteemed by his students as the unique one, Vahid, and the renovator, Mashaded, of the 13th Islamic century. A descendant of Muhammad Bagher Majlisi, the prominent theologian of the late Safavid era, and himself a refugee of the Afghan invasion and reign of Nader Shah, Behbahani succeeded in establishing the Usul school in Najaf, not just by triumphing in debates with his mostly Arab Akhbari opponents, or by producing legal works on Usul al-Fiqh. His greater success was building a network of patronage and a growing body of mostly Persian students who studied with him and with other senior Usuli cohorts in Najaf, with the intention of returning to Qajar, Iran, to occupy judicial positions. By the turn of the 19th century, the Usuli network was firmly in place in most Iranian cities, patronized by the state and the urban elite, and well assimilated into the religious affairs of its communities. Contrary to a number of aristocratic ulama families, both Arabs and Iranians, who dominated the teaching circles of Najaf and Karbala, known as the Atabat, or the thresholds, the mujtahids who returned to Iran were often of humble origins. Typically, they were village boys who had gone through arduous years of education in dire poverty and then returned home, equipped with one or several certificates, singular ijazah, from their Najaf teachers. Home often was a newly revived trading center, such as Isfahan, Yazd, Ghazvin, and Tabriz, a place where they could gradually build their constituency, prohibit the evil deeds, Nahni an al-Munkar, compete with one another for prestige and influence, and often amass fortunes. Perhaps the foremost example of an early 19th century Usuli is the celebrated Sayyid Muhammad Bagher Shafti, 1767-1844, a powerful mujtahid in Isfahan, whose career highlights all facets of the ulama's power and privilege. Before the 20th century days of prolific use of honorifics among the clergy, Shafti was the sole Shi'i figure referred to as Hujjat al-Islam, literally the proof of Islam, a title normally reserved in Shi'ism for the Imam of the age, which implied that Shafti was solid evidence of Islam's steadfastness. He was a poor boy from Shaft, 15 miles south of Rasht, who had gone through long stretches of madrasa education in Iran and attended the right teaching circles of Najaf while still living in dire poverty, subsisting on stale bread and rotten melons, as he reminisced in conversation with his students. In Isfahan, which was gradually regaining its status as the most important religious center in Iran, Shafti steadily rose in the clerical hierarchy, despite the fact that he was not a native of the city. He built his base by, among other things, issuing harsh legal opinions, lashing moral offenders, smashing wine cellars, crushing musical instruments, banishing prostitutes from the city, fining drunkards, and, if we trust his biographer, personally executing some of the 70 individuals he had sentenced to capital punishment. In one case, he beheaded an offender charged with pederasty and afterward said prayers at his burial. He held a popular teaching circle, appropriated the trusteeship of unclaimed or disputed pious endowments, or ghaaf, and acquired vast private properties that included shopping alleys, villages, and agricultural estates. Isfahan at the time was just beginning to recuperate from many decades of decline and depopulation. Shafti engaged in trade and acquired property in collaboration with a merchant from Gilan, enriching himself through astute investments and even money lending, in violation of the Islamic bans on usury. A key to his success was the immediate confiscation of collateral upon default, which in due course provided him with vast estates in and around Isfahan, as well as in Shiraz and Yazd. According to one source, by the 1830s, his wealth included 40 caravanserais, 1,000 shops, and a vast number of villages in the fertile district of Barajerd and in Yazd. Though perhaps exaggerated, such figures reflected the awe he inspired among the ordinary people of his time. Amassing such wealth was often associated with high-ranking officials or tribal khans, and seldom with members of the clergy, who normally held a reputation for frugality. Shafti was a bibliophile with a substantive private collection and a keen observer of domestic and regional affairs. On his Hajj pilgrimage, he took the Persian Gulf route, reportedly accompanied by 2,000 followers. He corresponded with Muhammad Ali Pasha of Egypt, then in control of the Hejaz, and reportedly persuaded him to endow the income from the famous Fadak hamlet, claimed by Fatima, daughter of Prophet Muhammad, to the Syeds of Medina. Shafti's response in 1839 to the British envoy Sir John McNeill on the question of Iranian claims over Herat reveals political astuteness and maturity, some knowledge of the British parliamentary system, and recognition of the legitimate authority of the Qajar state in matters of defence, governance, and diplomacy. Shafti, nevertheless, regularly made demands on the Qajar state that were more for his own interest rather than the public. His bickering with the government in his latter years tarnished his image even in the eyes of his followers as he resorted to violence and demagogy. Finally, it was left to the powerful governor of Isfahan, Manocher Khan Mutammad al-Dowle, a Georgian convert to Islam, to put an end to Shafti's rule. A shrewd state official, Manocher Khan had risen from being a eunuch in Fath Ali Shah's inner circle to the Shah's confidant, and then to one of the most powerful statesmen of the era of Muhammad Shah, reigned 1834 to 1848. In Isfahan, he crushed the city's brigands, lutis, and restrained Shafti's control of the market and the judicial affairs. Fath Ali Shah generally condoned the Mojtahed's growing power, granting them tax exemptions and reaffirming tenure over their properties. Royal patronage, however, was not the only grounds for the Mojtahed's success. They were astute manoeuvrers who negotiated with big landowners, merchants, and city officials. Haji Muhammad Hussein Isfahani, the future Sadr Azam of Fath Ali Shah, for example, sought Shafti's legal sanction to reconfirm his own hold on land and property. The mutual collaboration between Mojtaheds and members of the landed class did not exclude the Qajar state at the local and central levels, so long as the Mojtaheds were rewarded with lands and gifts from the Shah and his administration. The Mojtaheds were able to broaden their base through the madrasa, the mosque, and the bazaar. Their constituency included the lower clerical ranks, multitudes of students of the madrasa, talabeh, preachers and reciters of Mahram tragedies, and custodians of mosques and shrines. Their large and often chaotic teaching circles, where textual instruction was interlaced with practical adjudication of legal cases, offered hands-on education on how to become a Mojtahed. Big merchants, as well as smaller retailers and shopkeepers, were also among the Mojtahed's followers. Placing themselves in the clerical pecking order, Some urban Mojtaheds controlled the Luti brigands and, if necessary, incited a mob. It was not uncommon for the influential Mojtaheds to settle differences between the provincial governors or officials and other urban elite by inciting riots. Despite the Luti's popular image as protector of the weak, some terrorized neighborhoods, living a life of violence and heavy drinking, extortion and racketeering, and even sexual violations of young boys and women. Such crimes were often condoned by their patrons. At the lower echelon of the ulama hierarchy, the village mullahs offered religious instructors to the headmen and peasants, and often served as a nominal shield from the excesses of the government tax collectors and other sources of coercion. Fath Ali Shah's willingness to caress the Mojtahed's egos or assign to them monetary gifts and land tenure was not entirely out of love of Sharia. He must have been tempted to wash away the significant public evidence of his greed and lust with a good dose of religiosity. What was at stake, however, was the very credibility of Qajar rule, both domestically and in the face of menacing neighbours. The Shah had to keep the ulama content to acquire their approval, especially in dealing with the Europeans. Powerful Mojtaheds were aware of the Qajar's weakness and willing to exploit it. In 1811, while Sogor Uzli was in Tehran, the English evangelical missionary Henry Martin visited Iran to spread the message of Christ and find some converts among the Shi'i Iranians. Fiery but naive, he entered into theological disputation with a Shiraz Mojtahed, in which Martin was declared, rather unjustly, to be the winner. The clerical establishment all over the country was up in arms to prove that the Mojtaheds were the true saviors of Iran's Shi'i soul. In his treatise, young Martin challenged the veracity of Islam and the authenticity of the Prophet of Islam. In his private notes, he dreamed of Christianizing Iran and the rest of the Muslim world. The Shi'i Mojtaheds, by contrast, came across in their responses as more tolerant and open-minded, even if their approach to Martin's challenge was outmoded and decidedly oblivious to its colonial subtext. They were alert and consistent, but insular and intellectually unprepared. Martin did not win any converts, although his translation of the New Testament into Persian, published in 1815 in St. Petersburg by Uzli's support, and in 1816 in Calcutta by the Church Missionary Society, went through several editions. It was one of the earliest printed books to be widely distributed in Iran and have some impact on the Persian readership. Uzli's support for Martin and sponsorship for his translation of the Gospels, Uzli even presented a manuscript copy to Fath Ali Shah, may be seen as part of the English desire in the early decades of the 19th century to spread Christianity in Iran and India. Shi'i Iran offered even less fertile ground for conversion than India did. If the Martin episode demonstrated clerical vigilance in encountering a theological challenge, such wariness proved inadequate in the face of modern military threat. During the first round of wars with Russia, the ulama backed the state as the defender of Islam, waging jihad against infidel intruders. To save face, the Qajar state had to portray the 1813 defeat in war with Russia a temporary setback, not the final word. Subsequently, the Tabriz administration, under Mirza Bozorg Farahani, had to approach the prominent Mojtaheds of Iraq and Iran to seek their approval for another jihad against the Russia aggressor. The exercise also aimed to buttress Abbas Mirza's succession in the eyes of the public, as he faced new challenges from his ambitious brothers. The Mojtahed's responses, particularly a cogent one by Sayyid Ali Tabatabai, a respected teacher of Usul al-Fiqh in Najaf, served as the basis for the 1819 publication of a small volume titled Jihadiyya, on Jihad, the first publication to be produced by the newly founded government-run press in Tabriz. This exercise to seek public support by publishing a collection of fatwas far exceeded government expectations. As representatives of the Imam of the Age, the ranking Mojtaheds willingly accepted the Qajar state's initiative. They called for jihad on the grounds that defense of Muslim lands against outside aggression was an inalienable individual duty of all qualified believers. The Mojtaheds' assertions of their role as leaders of the community and their widening jihad to include all able-bodied civilians had important implications. On the one hand, it allowed mass mobilization to wage a successful war, while, on the other hand, it took the initiative out of the hands of the state in favor of the ulama. A few years later, a collection of fatwas by Muhammad Baqir Shafti, in the form of a catechism, written before 1826 but published in Tabriz in 1831, echoed the outmoded attitude of the mujtahids in dealing with the Russian challenge. It included a section on jihad and the believer's individual duty. Reinstating an arcane Islamic injunction, Shafti declared in one instance that all captives of war with infidels, no doubt a reference to the Russians, Armenians, and Georgians captured during the war in the Caucasus, were to be killed except for the children, the old, and the women who were to be enslaved. Oddly enough, the Russian captives, in practice, were welcomed and treated well, many preferring life in Muslim Iran over the arduous and inhumane lifetime of military service in the Tsar's army. Shafti's ruling, and similar opinions by other mujtahids, also showed the limits on the jurist's impact on the relaxed and often non-conforming Iranian public. The mujtahids were revered for their zeal and learnedness, but they were not always followed. Coming out of the madrasa and into the social arena, they sought status, wealth, and legal influence, and, while not disappointed, they were unable to fully dictate the course of state policy or dominate the minds and hearts of most of their followers. The equilibrium between the state and the clerical establishment, though, would soon be put to a new test. Defeat in the War and Turkmenchay Treaty. Among the reasons for renewed hostility were disagreements over implementation of the Treaty of Golestan, demarcation disputes, and anti-Russian resistance among the Muslim population of the annexed territories. At least some ranking Russian generals were determined to consolidate Russian gains as far south as the river Aras, which they considered the natural Russo-Persian border. Furthermore, for the majority of ulama and Iranian statesmen, the loss of the Caucasian provinces had not yet been fully absorbed. These anxieties became more transparent during the second round of wars with Russia between 1826 and 1827. Abbas Mirza was convinced that the price for his eventual confirmation as heir apparent would be a successful Persian offensive in the Caucasus. Only a small anti-war party at the Qajar court and administration were realistic about Iran's vulnerabilities and its prospect of defeat should it engage in another war with Russia. What seemed to have tipped the balance against the anti-war minority, however, was the call for jihad by prominent members of the ulama. Distraught by the fate of the Shi'i in the Caucasus under Russian occupation, who lived in fear of mass deportation, in July 1826, a group of mujtahids marched to Fath Ali Shah's military camp near Sultaniyye, today's Iraq, some 180 miles southwest of Tehran. They were led by, among others, Sayyid Muhammad Tabatabai, son of the previously mentioned Ali Tabatabai, who came to be known as Moja Head, Crusader, as well as by Muhammad Baqir Shafti. They pressed the war council, convened by the Shah, to opt for war with Russia. They also pressured the Shah and his officials to abandon negotiations with the enemy and ask the Russian envoy, General Alexei Yermolov, to leave the camp. The state had little choice but to comply. It was as if a spirit of defiance enwrapped the Qajar elite, which was patriotic and religiously galvanizing, but essentially untenable. Despite early advances by the new army into the interior of the Caucasus and the valiant resistance mounted by a handful of Qajar commanders, for instance, in the defense of the fortress of Abbasabad near Erevan, the Iranian forces were soon routed in a few short campaigns. The troops of General Ivan Fyodorovich Paskevich, the commander of the Russian army, secured control over the entire region north of the Aras, crossed the river, and marched in the direction of Tabriz. The celebrated general, a member of the Ukrainian Cossack gentry, epitomized the thrust of Russian imperialist ambitions. He had earlier distinguished himself during the Napoleonic Wars and also defeated the Ottomans in 1814, which made him a hero of the conquest of the Caucasus, but hated by the Iranians. Later, he would be equally despised by the Poles for his victory in the 1831 Battle of Warsaw during the Polish-Russian War. He also served as the commander of the Tsar's army that crushed the Hungarian Revolution of 1848. The demoralized Iranian camp was dispersed, most of the artillery deserted behind enemy lines, and Erevan and Nakhchivan, the last of the Iranian strongholds, fell into Russian hands. The expected uprising by the populations of Shirvan, Baku, Ganjar, and Tiflis never occurred, and the ulama, who had relied on mass resistance, could not persuade the people of Azerbaijan to organize a vigilante force or to put up a meaningful defense against the advancing Russian army. Some of the ulama of Tabriz did not even bother to pretend that there was a call for jihad. They were busy preparing speeches to welcome the Russian generals to the seat of the Qajar viceroy. Fleeing before the Russian army, Abbas Mirza himself, accompanied by his small entourage, had taken refuge in his summer residence in Khoi on the Ottoman border. Betrayed and disillusioned, he hoped at least to retrieve his capital through negotiation. The English envoy, John MacDonald Kinnear, summoned to help him, was obliged to lend the Crown Prince some cash for his subsistence. This was probably the lowest ebb of Abbas Mirza's career. Residing near Chaldiran, the scene of the decisive defeat in 1514, Abbas Mirza must have wondered how similar was his misfortune to that of Ismail I. The peace treaty of Turkmenchay, concluded in February 1828 between the victorious Russian army, then in control of the entire Caucasus and Azerbaijan, and even threatening to march on Tehran, and the demoralized Qajar officials, could not have been negotiated in a gloomier climate or with greater disadvantage for the vanquished party. Turkmenchay has often been deemed the most disastrous treaty in modern Iranian history, even though territorial Iran came out of the ordeal relatively intact. Perhaps it was the perseverance of the Iranian negotiators, with the assistance they received from the British, or the Russians' desire to conclude the peace because the prospect of another war with the Ottomans was looming large, which saved Iran from further humiliation and subservience, and perhaps even from the loss of all of Azerbaijan, or even Iran's descent into some kind of Russian vassalage. The final loss of 17 khanates of the Caucasus, consisting of the eastern part of today's Republic of Georgia, as well as the republics of Armenia and Azerbaijan, amounted to more than 10% of Iran's territory at the time, and more than 10% of its population of about 5 million. The Caucasian provinces were highly prized for their agriculture, silk production, trade, and manufacturing. The loss of revenue from the khanates, therefore, was substantial, perhaps as high as 20% of the Iranian government's total income of about 3 million tumans, $3,560,000. Politically, the loss of the Caucasian provinces was even greater, for it compromised the very prestige of the Qajar state as protector of Iran's guarded domains. The Qajar's tarnished image further cast a shadow on their ability to govern, as the post-war period witnessed insurgencies throughout the remaining years of Fath Ali Shah, especially in Khorasan. The war indemnity imposed by Russia, no less than 5 million tumans in gold, about 6 million US dollars or 20 million Russian silver rubles, was nearly twice the size of the Iranian state's annual income. Of the 4 million tumans collected immediately, a huge sum by any standard, a smaller part was drawn from the royal treasury, but the greatest portion was raised through extra taxation. Dispersing the indemnity brought the Qajar state to virtual bankruptcy. In addition, the victorious army carried away from occupied Ardabil vast possessions, including manuscripts and artifacts, from the shrine of Sheikh Safi ad-Din Ardabili, the patriarch of the House of Safavi. In Tabriz too, the defeated Qajar ruler was forced to make more gifts of great value to the Tsar in the hopes of lubricating peace negotiations. On his return to St. Petersburg, Paskevich received, in addition to a promotion and new title, a reward of 1 million rubles from the Tsar, which no doubt contributed to the construction of his vast estate and palace in Belarus. It was not only the Qajar state, but also the high-ranking Mojtah heads who also lost face. The hollow exhortation to wage jihad stood in sharp contrast to the realities of defeat. The transfer of the Shi'i population of the Caucasus, the so-called emigrants, Mohajireen, mostly to Iranian Azerbaijan, was a stigma and humiliation visible to ordinary Iranians. The Shi'i Muslims constituted the majority of the population of the most provinces of southern Caucasus, and their grievances had been a major reason for the outbreak of the war. In the Khanate of Iravan, they constituted as much as 80% of the total population. Although a majority remained in their homeland, the Russian government insisted on a population exchange, no doubt aimed to enhance the Christian identity of the annexed provinces. Over the course of the population exchange, a substantial segment of the Armenians, mostly from Iranian Azerbaijan, left their homeland to settle in Erevan province under the Russian aegis, while some of the Shi'i population of the Caucasian provinces immigrated to Iran. As late as the 1850s, the Iranian government was paying a hefty sum for the upkeep of the émigrés from the Caucasus. Much higher amounts, however, were paid over the years in installments to disperse the Russian war indemnity. Turkmenchai also reaffirmed Russia's commitment to Abbas Mirza as heir to the Persian throne, the only favourable term the devastated and ailing crown prince could procure during the treaty negotiations. The defeat had emboldened other senior sons of the Shah to challenge the crown prince, which in turn encouraged him to seek the Tsar's blessing. The end result was that the Tabriz administration accepted the harsh terms of the treaty to buttress Abbas Mirza's shaky stance. As far as the Russians were concerned, this was nothing short of Abbas's admission of his virtual vassalage status. Upon his death in 1833, the Russians, along with the British, imposed on Fath Ali Shah a purposeful reading of the article of the Treaty of Turkmenchai, according to which Abbas's son would succeed to the throne, which would remain hereditary in his house. For the rest of the Qajar period, the rule of primogeniture was observed in the house of Abbas Mirza, and with the blessings of the neighbouring powers. Although the new rule of succession did not prevent a mini-civil war after the death of Fath Ali Shah, the new order of succession was an important departure from the customary contest between sons of the deceased king, which often bore ruinous results for the state and society. The treaty also defined the Iranian northwestern frontier as it still appears today. The Iranians had exchanged peace treaties and settled frontier boundaries with their foes as early as 450 BCE in the aftermath of the Greco-Persian Wars. This was the first time, however, that Iran's boundaries with its neighbour Russia were defined by meticulous demarcations. This, in effect, initiated a process throughout the 19th century of defining Iranian boundaries vis-à-vis British India and the Ottoman Empire. Shaping an integrated Iran proper thus came at the expense of losing the periphery to the neighbouring powers. Russia's exclusive right to navigate both naval and commercial vessels in the Caspian Sea, reaffirmed in the Treaty of Turkmenchai, also deprived Iran of whatever control it had once held beyond the Caspian shores. The supplementary commercial treaty attached to Turkmenchai imposed on Iran equally important articles with long-term consequences. Russia acquired not only the right, long resisted by Iran, to open consulates in Iranian cities, but also the capitulatory rights of the so-called most favoured nations for Russian diplomatic representatives to preside over disputes between Russian and Iranian subjects. In due course, the denial of both the states and the Mojtahed's legal jurisdictions set a precedent for granting similar capitulatory privileges to other European nations, most notably to Britain, which concluded a new commercial treaty with Iran in 1841. Likewise, the supplementary commercial treaty granted Russian traders, and later other Europeans, fixed customs duties and other commercial advantages over their Iranian competitors, with negative results for Iran's balance of trade. The effect of the capitulatory rights was not in commerce alone. European powers routinely included these privileges for their own Iranian employees and clients. In the following decades, these protégés of the foreign legations frequently posed challenges to the authority of the Qajar state.